Hello and welcome to this podcast summary of the IASB board meeting held on Tuesday, the 16th of December 2014. My name's Mark Byatt. I'm joined today by Alan DeShearer, Senior Technical Director, and Steve Cooper, member of the IASB. So let's begin. Alan, perhaps you could kick off with a discussion of the post-implementation review of business combinations.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. This is almost the last phase of this review. We've undertaken, as people are probably aware, a public review of the business combination standard. The scope of the review covered not only the phase two, which was released in 2007, but also the earlier work that looked at things such as the removal of amortization of goodwill, for example. So it was a fairly broad review. The staff have had done a lot of consultation work with preparers and users, major accounting firms and regulators, looking for consistencies in practice and overall the effectiveness of the standard and whether it achieved its objectives. We also had an academic review, and at the session this week, Anne Tarker, who's an academic based in Australia, who undertook a lot of the review for us, presented a summary of that. And what was very helpful for this particular session, for those who want to read the paper, is it put into one place and contrasted the general comments that people made to us about the standard, and then match that with the academic evidence that we've got across there. And some of these, they contradict themselves a wee bit, and sometimes, and that in some cases people would say that, for example, impairment of goodwill is too slow, it's not happening contemporaneously with the drop in value. In other cases, the academic evidence actually found there was a reasonably contemporaneous association between those. So I think it's an interesting read, because it does contrast and look at some of the external independent evidence with some of the views that were collected in the process. What the board was asked to do was to look at some recommendations about assessing and ranking, I think, the most important areas of focus. And for those, again, who can pick up a copy of the paper and listen to the full meeting report from our website, paper 12B has a table and it identifies the two highest areas of interest. They both relate to goodwill, and essentially it's the subsequent accounting for goodwill once a business acquisition has taken place. They relate to how effective or complex the testing for goodwill for impairment is, which is not really a business combinations question. It's to do with our impairment standard. So the suggestion was that we review our IAS 36, which is the standard dealing with that. And interestingly, it's not converged with US GAAP. We have different impairment tests. We have different ways of grouping assets together in what we call cash generating units and so on. And the second was, there was a call from some areas, and quite geographically based in some cases, to revisit the subsequent accounting by actually reintroducing amortization. So the suggestion is that we should amortize goodwill over a defined period rather than just relying on an impairment test. And those are the two highest areas of interest. It is a converged standard, so there's also recommendation from the staff. We work with the FASB on this to make sure that we don't create a departure in the accounting requirements. Perhaps, I'm not going to go through the full list, but some of the other areas that were of particular interest were things like the definition of a business, and because we use the word business to define whether it's a business combination, the accounting is slightly different from accounting for acquisition of a group of assets. So that becomes a bit of a tension point at times. So essentially the board agreed with the ranking overall by the staff. The next step for this is that the staff are going drafting and putting together a feedback statement for public release. It will come back to the board likely to be in about February, just with some confirmation of next steps. For example, we could conclude this by saying, well, the highest area of focus was impairment testing of goodwill, but what are we going to do about that? Okay. So the staff will come back and have recommendations about whether that, for example, is just placed onto our research program as a project now, and perhaps whether some of the smaller issues should feed back into our maintenance and back to our interpretations committee.
Okay, thank you. One to watch out for in February. Steve, perhaps you could update us on the discussion on leasing.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. We had a discussion on one issue to do with leasing, which is the definition of a lease contract. In fact, I haven't really got anything to report because the conclusion from the meeting was that we're not going to change the definition.
Right.
So no actual positive decision was taken. Perhaps I ought to just explain what went on in the meeting, though. We've previously defined a lease as a contract that conveys the right to use an asset, which is the underlying asset, for a period of time in exchange for consideration. And that definition has been pretty stable, and we've given further supporting explanations to what that means. So in particular, what is the asset? The asset has to be clearly identified, either explicitly or implicitly. If, for example, a supplier has the substantive right to substitute a different asset and it has the practical ability to substitute and it can benefit from it, then we would say, well, there is no identified asset because the thing can vary. We also say that for something to be controlled, for the asset to be controlled by the customer, then you have to have actually the ability to direct the use of the identified asset and the ability to obtain substantial the economic benefit. So even though a lease might be called a lease, it doesn't necessarily result in meeting the definition that we're proposing, because you have to meet those criteria that I've just specified. The really important bit about this is to make sure that we capture leases as assets and liabilities in the balance sheet, but that we don't mistakenly put service contracts on the balance sheet, because we would say that a service contract does not create an identifiable asset and liability. And the whole point of this definition is to try and ensure that those service contracts are not captured. However, some people have suggested various amendments to this definition to improve it, to make sure that those service contracts aren't captured. So in this meeting, the board considered the possibility that we might add something else to this definition. And that is that the customer must have the ability to derive the benefits from directing the use of an identified asset on its own or together with other resources that are sold separately or that can otherwise be sourced in a reasonable period of time. And this addition, the board discussed, and we discussed a variation of it. We have two potential options to look at. But I think the conclusion at the end of it was that the definition that we've got at the moment is robust. It does appropriately identify leases and differentiate them from services. And the extra words that I just read out wouldn't really make any difference to the application of that definition in practice. It would add complexity and more uncertainty, but it wouldn't necessarily do a better job or indeed reduce the number of contracts that would be classified as leases. So we had a long discussion on it. It was a joint discussion with the FASB, but in the end, both the ISB and the FASB agreed not to add anything to the definition that we previously spent a long time debating and agreeing. So that was a long way of saying that we made no decisions at this meeting to make any changes to the definition of a lease.
Well, or retained your existing, we're comfortable with the existing.
Yes, yeah, we're comfortable with the existing decisions after due consideration.
Well, it's good to ask the question anyway. So, Alan, was there any discussion about the conceptual framework?
No, not this month. And that's not because we're not interested in it, obviously, but we're in a different phase of the project now. We've actually, as people will recall, last month the staff asked for permission to ballot, and that's exactly what we're doing. So we're in the drafting phase now, with we're still expecting to get this out in Q1 next year. So you won't see any discussion of framework now until the ED comes out, unless we identify what we call sweep issues during the drafting phase, where the staff are concerned the board has to kind of revisit some issue. And by the way, IFRS for SME has just entered that same phase again. We discussed it. Just some due process to clarify that the board was comfortable we can go ahead and start the drafting process. So a couple of big projects have headed in that phase.
Okay. So staying with you, Alan, I understand that there was some discussion on an interpretations committee issue for the accounting for cell phone towers.
Yeah, this is an issue to do with investment properties, and in that there's been a request that come to us and said, well, when people build a cell phone tower, so this is basically it's a tower with deflector panels on, etc., that for cell phone sites, the builder of that might not actually operate it themselves. It would actually would sublease out essentially the right to put the traffic through. And if you look at that, the argument is it's a little bit like building a building, and instead of occupying it yourself, you rent it out. And of course, for us, that's an investment property. So most of the consumption and the value you get out of it is through rentals and then through capital appreciation, as opposed to actually using it for other purposes. So the request has come in for us to extend IAS 40, which is our standard that deals with investment properties, to cover a cell phone tower. Our standard at the moment covers the thing buildings, and you know, the common definition of a building is it has walls and a roof, essentially. Cell phone towers don't. You don't live in and actually work inside a cell phone tower. Although arguably, you know, some of the cell phone towers do have that as a feature. They're sort of tacked on top of buildings. So the staff did some analysis about whether or not we should expand the scope of IS 40, so we extend it to cell phone towers. And that's the analysis they brought back. The board voted not to take this any further, and I just want to outline sort of two reasons for that. The first is it would be very difficult to try to constrain the scope of this, because if you bring cell phone towers into it, then arguably telecom cables, for example, that somebody builds, puts in place and then leases out to somebody else. It's very common around the world for public transport systems, their bus shelters and other things, built by a private provider who then lease out rent out all the advertising space on them. You can argue a bus shelter looks a lot more like a building than a cell phone tower, for example. So there's a concern that by extending it for one specific type of asset, we continue to get a stream of requests to others. And more fundamentally, by moving something like a cell phone tower into IS 40, you would actually then be requiring everybody to go and measure those at fair value, even if they don't recognise the fair value gains or losses. Because they choose the cost option, they would still have to disclose fair value. And we've just been through an exercise with the bearer plants issue in agricultural, where people were saying that continually having to measure some of those assets like that at fair value was quite burdensome and costly, and we decided for cost-benefit purposes to actually reduce the scope of IS 41, that's stand on agriculture, to remove bearer plants from it. So it didn't seem that it met the criteria here for putting a lot of energy board time into a simple extension or a narrow extension of IS 40. There are just too many potential consequences that we didn't think were worth taking.
So another decision to retain the existing approach.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's pretty much covered, I think, everything that was discussed during the board meeting. So just a more forward-looking signposting of something that's happening tomorrow, indeed, which is the announcing or issuing of amendments to IAS 1 as part of the disclosure initiative.
Yeah, that's a big thing for us, because it's last year we announced a sort of a 10-point plan that followed on from our public disclosure forum or discussion forum on disclosure. And tomorrow, I think there are five of those steps are actually wrapped up in one series of amendments. So that brings to about six steps completed so far. As people will know, the Disclosure Initiative is a portfolio of projects. It's got some targeted actions, and as well as a broad and quite ambitious review of disclosure requirements generally. We see this as being particularly important because the amendments are going to, we hope, and signals are very positive from around the world, they're going to encourage companies to apply more professional judgment in determining how to present their information. At the moment, there's a sense that our standard constrains them. You know, it tells them there's a particular order to present the notes, and you can't present the most important first and group them in a way that tells a story about the company. It's a more formulaic. So we're releasing some of that, and some of the changes relate to the application of materiality, making it much clearer that you apply the concept to the statements as a whole, including the notes. And so just, you know, we might provide, for example, a list of required disclosures or specified disclosures, as people say. It might be 10 items on this list. You don't, if something is clearly not material, you don't have to disclose it, and we're going to re-emphasize that.
Okay.
It's important because we see that this could be the catalyst for some behavioral changes in the way people present the information.
Okay. So issuing of amendments to IAS 1 and the publication of an exposure draft on IAS 7.
Yeah, not everything in the Disclosure Initiative is about removing disclosures. In this case, we think that providing additional disclosure around financing activities, which is close to a net debt sort of information that a lot of investors have asked for, actually brings together some pieces out of different parts of the report into one place. So you can actually improve the quality by bringing together some related information.
Okay, to look out for. So next meeting of the IASB will be in January, between the 19th and the 23rd, January 2015. Got the trustees meeting in Zurich at the beginning of February. So I think that's pretty much it. Season's greetings to everyone. That leads me to just make the obligatory health warning that these are the personal views of the presenters and may not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The official summary of the board meeting is provided by the IASB update, which is available to download from the IASB website. Thank you.